Hi, hey, welcome. If you have never been to the gathering before and you're going, I thought this was a young adult ministry, who's the old guy up there? I'm one of the pastors here at Crossings, and if you normally come to the gathering, you've probably seen me a time or two before, so it's nice to be with you all. Let me start us off with a question, though. What makes you angry? I mean, what makes your blood boil? I don't mean what annoys you, like traffic or like bureaucracy or having to fill out one more form at a governmental office. I don't mean that stuff. That's irritating. I'm talking about what are the things that really bug you. I mean, deep down inside, they grate you. They're probably the big things of life, right? Injustices, abuse either of people or systems or of power, those sorts of things. So here's the question that goes along with it. When you feel that, what do you do? How do you respond when you feel that gut level of anger at something? I know some of you personally, I know some of you chose majors and careers based upon things that you observed. You go, this isn't how it ought to be. So I'm going to get involved in something involved with medical or engineering or education because things aren't as they ought to be. And I'm going to exact the change I can in business or otherwise. So that had a role to play. Maybe you know someone who organized a community of people to protest or to fight something. But if you're like most of us, when you get really deep down inside angry at something, you just do on it. Maybe turn to a person and complain. Maybe pontificate on social media, vent a little bit. All right, a similar question, a little bit different. When Jesus felt the same way, how did he respond? See, there's a story in the scriptures. It's an encounter with Jesus. And my guess is, as I read it to you, some of you go, that's in the Bible? It's not only in the Bible, it's in there three times. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record this story of Jesus. I'm going to look at the one that's in Mark 11. So if you have a copy of the scriptures or if you like to follow along, words on the screen, or you can grab your smart device and follow along. And this is where it starts. It starts in verse 12. Mark tells us, the next day as they were leaving Bethany, which was a town next door to Jerusalem, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the fig tree, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard him say it. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts, and he began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations? But you made it a den of robbers. And the chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him, because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. And when evening came, Jesus and his disciples, they went out of the city. And in the morning, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. And Peter remembered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered. How many of you knew that story was in the Bible? Bunch of you, but there's a bunch of you like, that's the weirdest story of Jesus that I didn't know was in there. And now that I know it's in there, I'm not entirely comfortable that it's in there. This is one of the stories that doesn't get talked about a whole lot because at first glance, it looks like Jesus is just in a bad mood. He's hungry or hangry, as the saying goes. He wants something to eat. He goes over. There's no figs on the fig tree, even though there shouldn't be figs on the fig tree. And he curses the fig tree. Seems a little random. Then he goes into the temple. Maybe again, he's hangry. So he just starts chucking things and drives people out. And let's talk about something else, like maybe the part where he makes food for people or heals people or does some sort of blessing. But definitely one of these kind of stories isn't the kind of story that most of us like to memorize or think too much of. In fact, there was a group of scholars a generation ago, and they would get together and they would have seminars. I'm not making this up. They would have seminars. They called it the Jesus Seminar. You can look this stuff up. And they would get together, and they were New Testament scholars, and they would vote. They'd literally read parts of the Gospels, and they'd go, who thinks that was in the original text? And they'd have a raise of hands. And anything, I'm not making this up, anything that made Jesus seem harsh or strong, voted out. Everything that made him look kind of sweet and loving, like the giving food and stuff, all that got to stay. But anything like this got voted out, which was really funny. This seminar where they would vote on this stuff, as they described Jesus, he turned into a one-dimensional character that filled your stockings every December 25th. They ended up describing Santa Claus, not the Lord Jesus. So what's this story about? The scholars who trust this story, they say this story, both of them, the fig tree and the temple, say the same thing. They're both strong statements of this reality. And this is the reality that Jesus is the true Lord and therefore is the rightful judge. And his judgments are just and his discipline is right. Now, you see why this story is a little bit uncomfortable? He's expressing his authority to call what is wrong, wrong, and to deal with it according to his own judgments. That's what this story is. And because this story's here, what I want us to do, and we're gonna slowly crawl through this story, I want us to look at three different implications for this story. And the first implication is this, is that fruitless activity will not be rewarded. Fruitless activity will not be rewarded. Let's look again at the fig tree story. It says the next day, they're leaving Bethany. Again, it's a town not too far from Jerusalem, and they're walking to Jerusalem. Jesus is hungry. He sees in the distance a fig tree, and the fig tree's in what? What's it say? The fig tree's in, come on, let's try it. The fig tree is in, leaf. There we go. Let's do it again. The fig tree is in leaf. Okay. So it's got leaves on the fig tree. All right. So since there's figs, leaves on the fig tree, he went out to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but, what's he find? Leaves. Nothing but leaves. There we go. Because it was not the season for figs. Okay. And he said, well, no one will ever eat figs from you again. And he curses it. And later we find out, of course, it takes. Now, if any of us in the room were horticulturists or fig tree experts, this story would make complete sense. See, to us, and I had to look this stuff up, I think, boy, Jesus is being a little harsh on a fig tree that shouldn't be having figs anyhow. Except there should be something before there's figs. There should be what's called pegim. And they would be about the size of the end of your thumb, and it would be a little green pre-fig, a small fig, not too tasty. How many of you have ever had a kumquat? Any of you had a kumquat? A kumquat is like a little orange, and it tastes nasty. So if ever someone's like, hey, try a kumquat, they're just playing a trick on you. They don't taste good at all, but they look like little oranges. Now, kumquats do not become oranges, just for the record, but little figs, little pegim become figs. And when there's leaves on a fig tree, there should be little pegim all over the fig tree. And if you're hungry, you could eat it. And if you're really, really hungry, it might fill you up. But if you weren't hungry, you wouldn't go near the thing. And so in this story, there is nothing but leaves. And Jesus goes over and he finds not a thing besides the leaves. You see, the fig tree is all dressed up for show. Do you know what you do or what you call a fig tree? What you call a fig tree that no longer produces figs? A nuisance. It's a waste of space. And if you're a farmer and you have an orchard and there is a fig tree and there's no more figs on the fig tree, you take the fig tree out. Jesus actually tells a parable in another part of the Gospels about that very thing. It's in Luke, and he says this. This is Luke 13. He says, he tells this parable. He says, a man had a fig tree growing in his vineyard, and he went to look for figs on or fruit on it, and he didn't find any. So he said to the man who took care of the vineyard, for 3 years, I've been coming back looking for fruit on this fig tree, and I haven't found any. Cut it down. Why should it use up the soil? And the guy says, sir, leave it alone for one more year, and I'll dig around it, and I'll fertilize it, and if it bears fruit next year, fine. If not, then what'll I do? I'll cut it down. And this parable, just like all parables, were sneaky stories that Jesus told to slip under the radar. And as you listen to the story, you're like, that's a great story. But when you got home over dinner, you went, wait a minute, that story was about me. I'm the prodigal son. I'm the lost sheep. I'm the lost coin. Oh my word, that's not just some neat story. The story was aimed right at my heart. And this fig tree story is that story. The person who heard it would go, huh, that's interesting. Yeah, of course, a fig tree doesn't produce figs. You got to cut it down. But I wonder what the whole bit about giving it a little extra time to, I think I'm the fig tree. You see, because before Jesus tells this parable, there's a greater conversation where people are going, hey, do bad things happen to bad people who deserve it? And he said, no, they just happen to people. The world you live in is broken. Just because a tower falls on some people and died like it did in that one town, it didn't mean they're worse than you. So what do you need to do? You need to repent. You need to quit sinning and you need to turn to God. It's like this. There's a guy and he has a fig tree and the fig tree's not producing figs. So he decides to cut it down. But the steward of the farm says, give it a little bit more time. But if the fig tree never produces figs, it's going to come down. And in ancient Hebrew literature, the fig tree was always a representation of the nation, of the people, of a person. And so when Jesus picks up on the theme here, or in the story that we're talking about tonight, it's a parable unfolding. See, there's a fig tree, and Jesus goes, and he knows there should be something on the fig tree. He's not expecting ripe fruit. That's good news. He's expecting, though, something. And if there's nothing there, and it's all just leaves, there's a real problem. And he's going to deal with it. Now, there's good news mixed into it. Just like the parable in Luke, there's this theme that occurs in Old Testament and New Testament. And this theme is one of the qualities of God. And the quality is called long-suffering. And long-suffering in the old Hebrew is erech apayim. That is generally how it would have been said in Hebrew. And it just meant long nostrils. That's literally what it meant. And it doesn't mean that God has a huge nose. It means like a long nostril. I don't know if this has happened to you, but when I was a kid, I would kind of press my dad's buttons. Sometimes I just did it for sport, and sometimes I did it without knowing it. But regardless, my dad would play along, but at some point my dad would do this, and I knew, stop it, because what comes after that is not good. And God is, he's long of the nose. He'll draw in the breath. But you know what comes after that? You better get with the program. So he's patient, but a life that is just for show, that doesn't bear any fruit, this is a real problem. And so here's a reflection question. This is the first reflection question. Am I bearing fruit or just leaves? Or another way of saying it, am I just putting on a show? Is my life full of pretense? Do people look at my life and from a distance they go, they got it together, but the truth is, I'm just putting on a show. Because Jesus had some harsh words for a fig tree, but he wasn't talking to a fig tree. All right, there's a second implication. The second implication of this great reality that Jesus is the Lord and therefore the judge and his judgments are right. Here's the implication. Treating as common that which is sacred will be punished. I didn't make the rule. I'm just observing a reality here that unfolds in the New Testament. And this is where we see it. He says, on reaching Jerusalem, Jesus enters the temple courts and he began driving out those who were buying and selling there. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. And he wouldn't let people pass through that were carrying merchandise through the temple courts. And then he teaches them. And he says, is it not written, my house should be called a house for all nations, but you turned it into a den of robbers. And my 17-year-old son, just last week, as a matter of fact, he invoked this story. We were just driving down the road, and he said, Dad, how is it that Jesus did that and didn't sin? I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, he obviously was angry. And I said, well, wait a minute, man. Do you think that just being angry is a sin? And that was kind of his default setting. And you might have heard that too. Someone might have said that to you, oh, don't be angry. And there's some verses in the scripture that seem to indicate that. But there's a clear couple verses that indicate something very different. This is what the Apostle Paul says to the Christians living in the town of Ephesus. He writes him a letter, and this is just what he does. He says, in your anger, don't sin. And Paul isn't making up that sentence. He is quoting from the Greek Old Testament book of Psalms. And in Psalm 4:4, it says, be angry, but do not sin. In your anger, don't sin. So how do I do that? How can I be a person that expresses anger without sinning? Let me offer a few suggestions to you. Here they go. How can I express anger and not sin? Root the offense in objective biblical principles. That is, principles that stand the test of time, that have been communicated through Scripture since the beginning or reiterated from Old to New Testament. Build what offends you or what is you consider offensive around biblical principles. Second idea, seek justice, seek what's right. And number three, insist on accountability. Now, I know what some of you are thinking right now. If I do this, it could cost me a relationship, it could cost me a job, and absolutely. You read the early church leaders from the New Testament right on through the beginning of the church, and when people stood up for what was right, it always cost them dearly, but they were always willing to stand up for what is right. So how do you express anger and sin? Because I know sometimes that's fun. So here's some suggestions you could do. Root offense in personal slight, subjective opinion, or personal pride. So make it personal. Whatever you grew up culturally, doesn't matter if it's in the Bible or not, as long as you find it offensive, by all means, express that offense to others. Number two, seek revenge or retaliate. Forget about justice. If someone knocks your tooth out, as the scriptures say, knock all their teeth out. That's not in the Bible. Just to be clear. Retaliate. Or insist everyone knows how angry you are. Just let everybody know. Don't keep a journal. Keep a blog. Name names. It might cost you, but it'll be fun in the process. And it'll offend more people. You might have less relationships. Who knows? You might make a whole new set of friends that also like to complain. The story of Jesus cleansing or purging the temple has been the subject of art through the years. And an artist, an Italian artist named Giotto, he painted this fresco here that you'll see on the screens. And this fresco is one of my favorites. This is, if you're ever in Italy, this is in the Sovini Chapel, kind of over on the Aegean Sea side of things, as I understand the geography of Italy. And of course, that is Jesus in the middle in red because he has a halo and his fist is cocked. I mean, most of the images are Jesus like from a distance yelling at people. I like the Italians here. And I love the dude in purple because he's like, this is going to hurt. He's wincing in preparation. And I know this is totally fictitious. I do know this. But I like to play this scene out a little bit. And I wish it was like four different panels. Because by panel four, the guy'd be on his like back, knocked out. And Jesus would be like, that's right. Who wants more? But I, again, I'm acknowledging it's fictitious. But imagine if he did punch a guy, and then later that guy hears the gospel a couple weeks later and becomes a Christian. And then he's at like some sort of testimony time, and people are like, when did Jesus become real to you? And he's like, when he punched me. That would be fantastic. And then he goes to heaven, and people are like, hey, when's the first time you encountered Jesus? And he's like, let me tell you. Again, I made up the fictional part of all that. And for some of you right now, you're like, Jesus didn't throw a punch. He just used his outdoor voice. These are people who have a business. And in their business, they're in it to make money. And if some guy came in and said, don't do that here, they'd be like, you go away. And so there was evidently some physical force that he uses to push them out. In fact, the terminology that's in the scriptures is it says he drove out. He drove them out. And the word drove out, the old Greek word there is ekbalin, which has this intense sound to it, not just in the way you say it, but it has an intense connotation to it. What it means is to forcibly push somebody out. So like someone has been offensive in the family and the whole family shuns the person and pushes them out and says, you can't come to anything anymore. Or they get banished from a town or from some society, or the terminology is used a little more crass to refer to like maybe you ate something that upset you and to expunge it from your system, only maybe you're in there for a while. But when you're done, you are done. Ekbalin. And Jesus drove them out like an upset stomach responds to something through the intestines. And they were out. And so here is Jesus. And he is throwing down. He's not playing games. They might have been playing games. They might have been treating what was sacred with just commonness. But for Jesus, this is extremely, extremely offensive. And so here is my question for you. This isn't the reflection question. This is the pre-question for you. When you think of your connection with God, does that race your heart? Does that excite you? Or as you think about your relationship with God, is it just humdrum? Another way of looking at it is fast forward your life 50 years from now, 75 years from now, 100 years from now. You're like, I won't be alive 100 years from now. Right. Not here, but you will be somewhere. And the thought of being in the presence of God, does that excite you? Does that cause your heart to race? Do you go, I don't know what that's going to be like, but I kind of want to know? Or do you kind of go, oh, that's going to be so boring? I remember when I was a little kid, we'd have like hymn singing festivals on Sunday night, and the minister would go, if you love that, just wait till heaven. And as a little kid, I was thinking, what's the other place offer? That doesn't sound good. It's not that. It's way better than that. Better than you can imagine. But as you imagine, is God in the middle of all that in your life? Is he in the middle of all that energy? Or is it just sort of like, I hope he's not watching too close? You see, if Jesus is the true, if he's the true Lord, if he is truly the Lord of my life, then he's going to figure out if I'm playing a game. If this is all true, he will know. And so here is the real reflection question. Is religion, is faith just a game? Is it just a game I play, or is it a journey I'm on? And here's the deal. Only you know that. See, the first one, your friends know. The first ones, your friends will be like, well, they kind of put on a good show, but deep down inside, I know they're no, you know, they got some issues. But here, you go further along in your faith journey, you could easily fake it. And only you know. Only you know. And so this kind of just leans in to another issue that we have. This is implication number three. This one frightens me the most of all. Should frighten all of us in this room. So I'll just prepare you now for it. Proximity to the symbols of God and the church does not automatically produce a genuine faith. You can be around all of this. You can be in a Sunday school class, a small group. You can be regular in church attendance. And it could be inauthentic. You could go to a seminary. You could get ordained. And you could be even deeper as a fraud. Now, like I said, this one frightens me. This one, there's an odd teaching of Jesus. It's in the Sermon on the Mount. And he says, there's going to be a lot of people that on the day of judgment come to me and say, Lord, Lord, didn't we do this? And didn't we cast out demons? And didn't we do all this? And Jesus will say, I don't know who you are. I never knew you. Away from me. And they're cast out. And the way that they're described is they're actually people who are doing really good religious stuff. They just happen to be fake. And I wonder if they knew they were fake. See, that's the part that terrifies me the most. You could go through all the emotions, or all the motions, I should say, and it could be inauthentic, and you might know it in your quiet moments. And you might not. You might have convinced yourself it's all real. But in the quietest of moments, you know, it's really all about me. It's not about anybody else. It's not about God. It's about me. And so proximity to all this doesn't guarantee a genuine faith. And here's how we know it. Verse 18, it says, the chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this, and they began looking for a way to what? Kill him. They began looking for a way to kill him. For they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. Let's look at the fresco painting just one more time. See the guys way off to the far right? Poor Giotto ran out of room. But you see them? They're like rubbing noses. That's the religious leaders. That's his symbol. Jesus is cleaning house. And those guys are like, murmur, 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 murmur. You got to get rid of that guy. The chief priests and the teachers of the law, of all people, should have known better. You see, the chief priests, this was the highest ranking of the priestly class. They were in charge of the temple. They had been to all the proper schools, learned all the proper etiquette. They started their day with all the scripture readings and did it throughout the day. They did it before they went to bed at night. They went through all of the stuff. They had all of the literal vestments on. They had all the trappings. When they walked through town, people parted because they were chief priests. They had the nice homes in a nice neighborhood. Their kids went to private school. They should have known. And the teachers of the law, those are like Bible study bingers. These are the people, some of them may have been like, you're like Bible college people, but they could have just been people that went to every Bible study they could get their hands on, read every religious tract or book they could get their hands on. They set up their religious blog to present their theories of this, that, and the other thing. They should have known better of all groups of people, because when Jesus sat down to teach, we just get essentially the title of the sermon. Otherwise, it was the shortest sermon he gave. So we're left to assume this is the title, and here's the title of the sermon. Is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it a den of robbers. Lost on us, if you don't know the Old Testament, you're like, wow, okay, that seems nice to say, I guess. But Jesus is quoting from two of the major prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah. And in Isaiah, just the little verse referenced was part of something much bigger. And I just want, for sake of context, just give you a little bit of it. This is in Isaiah 56, starting with verse 3. We'll just skip around a little bit. Isaiah writes this, "Let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, 'The Lord will surely exclude me from his people.'" Don't say that. Don't say that. "And let no eunuch complain, 'I'm only a dry tree.'" Don't say that. No, no, no. "For this is what the Lord says, foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it and who hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain," which is an expression for Jerusalem and really an expression for the temple, that holy mountain. "I'll bring them to my holy mountain and I'll give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." I want everybody in, God says. He first reveals it to Abraham and the Hebrew people, but that was just gateway, and they were supposed to, God was going to bless them to bless the people around them, to be a testimony of God's goodness through the Hebrew people. And so some of the non-Hebrew people, which is probably most of us in this room, were like, "I'd like to be part of that." And so the prophet Isaiah is telling the people, non-Hebrew people who are devout and want to come before the Lord, they are welcome at the temple too, because the temple is supposed to be not just a house of prayer for the Hebrews, but a house of prayer for all people. And by the time of Jesus, it was a new temple that had been recently constructed, and there was this vast temple complex that was magnificent. And in the big temple on the top, only the high priest could go in there. But around that was a court, and that court was only for the priestly class. But if you went down about a dozen steps, you went into another courtyard, and that was for the Hebrew men. They could get pretty close to the temple, but they couldn't get too close. And then down another dozen steps, there was a court of, Hebrew women, the women. And another dozen steps down, there was a court for the Gentiles. So imagine you're coming from Antioch, or maybe you came from parts of North Africa like Alexandria, and you were excited to go to the temple because you love the one true God, creator of the universe. You read the Greek Old Testament. That's what you have access to. And so you take your trip to Jerusalem, once in a lifetime trip, and you get there and you get into the courtyard and you can see the temple because it's high, but you know you can't go any further than the court that's designated for you. And as you're there gathering with some friends to maybe have a little Bible study or sing some songs or maybe pray together, there's someone back here going, "Two doves for a buck. Get your money exchanged over here." Just a beautiful moment of worship, wouldn't it? Just imagine how that would lift your spirit ever so close to God. It was rude and it was disruptive. And it meant the Gentiles couldn't worship. And Jesus is saying, "My house is to be a house of prayer for all nations." People shouldn't have to come into the worship space and be disrupted by this. But it wasn't just that. See, at that point, the Bible study nerds, they should have been like, "Hey, time out, he's got a point there. I told Randy he shouldn't let the doves and the sheep in here. He should have sold them out there, but. But they said nothing. But that wasn't the end of Jesus' sermon. He's like, "You've turned this place into a den of robbers." Now, not like lion's den where lions live, but like a clubhouse for wicked people. See, he's pulling a quote out of the prophet Jeremiah. I'll give you just a little flavor of it. He says, this is, by the way, the prophet Jeremiah back in his day, which was hundreds of years before the time and ministry of Christ, he stood outside the old temple at that point, and he kind of preached this message to the people because they viewed the temple as a lucky rabbit's foot. King Nebuchadnezzar's forces were outside the city, but everybody's like, "Hey, the city's safe, the temple's in here, God's here, God's not gonna let his temple be touched." And this is what Jeremiah says to him: "Will you steal and murder? Commit adultery, perjury, burn incense to Baal, and follow other gods who you have not known? And then come stand in here before me in this house, which bears my name, and say, we're safe. Safe to do all these detestable things. Has this house, which bears my name, become a den of robbers? No, I've been watching, declares the Lord. And what comes after that is this is all going to be burned to the ground and you with it. It wasn't one of the favorite memories of the Hebrew people. And it certainly wasn't a favorite memory of the chief priests and the Bible study experts. And they knew Jesus was talking about them. He was saying something very strong against them. And at that point, they should have responded. Let me ask you this. When you're confronted for something, how do you respond? I don't mean when you're accused of something you didn't do. I mean, you know you did it. And someone says, I need to have a word with you. And if you're a mature person, one of the marks of maturity, when you're confronted and the shoe fits, you say, thank you for having the courage. I don't like to hear this, but I know it must have been hard for you to say it. I need to hear this, even though I don't want to hear this. Or maybe if you're very mature, you go, I could use your help growing through this. That's a mark of maturity. Maybe if someone's confronting you and you're not sure, you're not sure if the shoe does fit, you might say, I need to really think on this. Could we circle back around to this? Could maybe we get some other people involved? Because I don't know that I'm being represented fairly here. Those would be mature ways to respond when confronted. But one of the ways you should never respond when you're confronted is circle up with some friends and go, let's kill him. Let's kill her. If that is a gut instinct of yours, you have a problem. You don't need a small group. You need a probation officer and a small group and see our care ministry and come to a lot of programs that we have available for you. And then if you end up doing it, we'll still minister to you in jail. But that should... It is a growing ministry of ours. But you should not do that. It shouldn't even be an instinct of yours. And it's the chief priests and it's the experts of the Bible. They're the ones, and this is their instinct. And it gets worse. It gets worse because off to the side, besides like the opportunity to buy goats and doves and sheep and maybe a cattle or two for the offering, you'd exchange your money. You see, because an average person in the Roman Empire, they would have Roman currency, and on Roman currency would be either Roman gods or the most common would be the face of the emperor, and you don't bring the filthy face of the emperor into the temple. I mean, that would be inappropriate to bring Emperor Tiberius' face into the temple. And so you'd have to exchange the Roman currency for currency that the chief priests had assigned and said, we will accept this currency, but we won't accept the Roman currency. So you have to exchange it. And that was taking place in the court of the Gentiles. They were exchanging the Roman currency for this right here. It's called a Tyrian shekel. And this was the accepted currency that you would have to exchange your Roman currency, and you'd have to get one of these, and then you'd have to pay your temple tax with one of these. You know whose face is on it? A guy named Marcot. Not really a guy, he's a god. A Tyrian god. He goes by other names like Baal. And if you know your Old Testament history, that's offensive. So you can't have Tiberius's face in the temple, but you can have Baal's. And it was the chief priest that decided it was okay for Baal's face to be in here, but not Tiberius' face to be in here. Because, by the way, the Tyrian shekel was worth more, and the exchange rate favored the temple. And that's always cool. Oh, did I also mention when this all rolls out? I don't think I did. This is day one of Holy Week. So, just a little... add a little salt to the whole story is that Tyrian shekel. About 4 days later, 30 of these would be given to Judas to betray Jesus. Let's let that sink in for a minute. These are the people that are closest to the symbols and emblems of religiosity. They have the place of prominence around the temple. They can lay hands on the exterior of it. If you're high enough rank, you can even go in it from time to time. And when confronted with a hard truth, the instinct is to commit homicide. It's just proof that anyone, if it happens to them, it can happen to us. You probably won't commit homicide, but you could certainly be around all the symbols and lack any sort of genuine faith. And so here's the reflection question. What role does God really play in your life? I mean, what's he really play in your life? This is a question that before you slip off to sleep tonight, as you're laying there in bed, this could be the prayer. God, what role, honestly, do you really play in my life? There's a terrific little book by C.S. Lewis. It's one of his less popular books. It's called The Weight of Glory. Highly recommend it. Short, punchy. And Lewis, he writes this in one of his chapters. He says, I read in a periodical the other day that the fundamental thing is how we think of God. By God himself, it is not. How God thinks of us is not only more important, but infinitely more important. Indeed, how we think of him is of no importance except insofar as it is related to how he thinks of us. It is written that we shall stand before him, shall appear, shall be inspected. God sees through the leaves. God knows if we're playing a game. Even if no one else around us knows it, he knows. God knows the role that we have assigned to him. Even if we tell everybody else he plays a much more prominent role, he knows. He knows. God knows. Lewis goes on to, he says this, he says, the promise of glory is the promise almost incredible and only possible by the work of Christ. That some of us, that any of us who really chooses shall actually survive that examination, shall find approval, shall please God, as he said it, through the work of Christ. We have a choice to make. We have a partnership with him. He might incline our hearts. He's the first mover. He might do the pushing. But eventually, sometimes we sing these songs. Sing them in this room sometimes. They're good songs. But sometimes we sing these songs that God will like run over a mountaintop looking for you. Might do it once or twice. But at some point, if you go, look, I don't want to be found. Or I just want people to think I am. At some point he says, fine. You see, what he thinks of you is of infinite importance. But what we think of him, here's the relationship. As we think of him, as we value him, as we place him and give him the position of prominence in our lives, that's the issue. And so as we enter into this 120 seconds, the three reflection questions will appear back on the board. You come into a place like this, you might have just needed a reprieve from work, opportunity to connect with friends, maybe make a new friend. Those are good goals. But I know in a room like this with as many people, I just know. It doesn't take mathematician, it doesn't take veteran pastor status. I just know that in a setting like this, that there's a few of us, if we are honest, we would go, I've been playing a game. I'm dressed up for show, not much fruit. No fruit. And so don't leave here tonight. We have people who pray with you, for you. They're off to the side, they're in the front. Find your way there during the next song, during the next moments. Whatever you do, don't just escape out of here and go, you know what, this is really spoken to me next week. I'm gonna give this some thought next week. I'm gonna circle back through. You know what, in my small group on Thursday, I'm gonna bring this, no. Have a little courage, have a little fortitude. Tonight, forget about the leaves, start bearing some fruit. Forget about the games, start the journey. Place God number one in your life. Father, would you give us the honesty to look in deep into our souls, let you speak, let you move, challenge our hearts, transform us, we pray.